Write yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, today we have a number of very interesting developments over the past week, which we will do a round-robin review of. And then the second half of the show, I'm going to talk about financial imperialism. What do we mean by that? Well, as I've mentioned last week, I've just published a book that's now available from Clarity Press called Financial Imperialism. Actually, the title has to do with Greece, and the subtitle, Greek Debt and the Greek Debt Crisis, and the subtitle, of course, is Financial Imperialism. We'll talk more about that particular book, but it's a extension of a previous book I published earlier this year called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, if you remember that. I've talked about that a little bit. A deep analysis, perhaps too lengthy, but nonetheless, a deep analysis of why and how the global economy is becoming more financially unstable and fragile, and how we are moving towards, in the next 5 years, who knows, sooner or later, another financial crisis of major dimensions, maybe even greater than the one we had here in 2008-09. And that's because the massive buildup of private debt, corporate debt, is still continuing. It was that private debt buildup that really underlay the crash in 2008-09, and it's accelerated since that time, and accelerated with the great assistance of the central banks, like the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank, Bank of Japan. They are pouring credit and liquidity, money, into the private system, the private economy, with super, super low and now negative interest rates. And corporations are just loading up on the debt. They call that leveraging. Loading up massively on even more debt, and that's occurring everywhere. Now it's occurring in China. It didn't occur in the 2008 run-up and crash in China. The China experience is a post-crash experience. In other words, China joined the bandwagon, you might say, of private debt buildup, and that makes the next crash even more serious. Debt in China, corporate debt, private corporate debt, is somewhere between 170 and 200% of the gross domestic product. You know, so if their GDP is running 10, 11 trillion a year, then we're talking somewhere between 20, 30 trillion dollars of private corporate debt in China alone. The problem with debt is that it's got to be paid. And as long as times are good and the economy is going well and prices are rising and sales are increasing and so forth, then companies, corporations, can pay the principal and interest on that private debt. Ah, but when it all slows down in the real economy, as it is now globally, or slows down at an accelerating pace, which we call recessions and contractions, then the source of income available to continue paying the principal and interest on the debt disappears. They can't pay the debt. They can't make their payments. They face default. Well, an alternative is to borrow more money in order to pay the old money. Ah, but when you have a contraction and a crash, the banks don't want a loan anymore because they're the ones holding a lot of the debt that defaults, and they have losses at the same time as private corporations who can't pay to the banks. They don't loan anymore, and that, of course, has the effect of prophecy coming true. They can't pay. Private corporations can't pay the banks for the debt they borrowed. And now you're in the downward spiral of debt default and deflation of assets. And that's coming again. It's just not possible to pay off the debt in that massive amount. What governments do, if corporations can't borrow from banks to keep financing their debt, what governments do is step in and bail out the private sector and take that bad debt onto their own government balance sheets. So you see, government debt is a function of transferring private corporate debt onto their own balance sheets. It's also a function of when you have crises and deep contractions or slow growth, then you have deficit spending, revenues drop off, spending has to increase, even with austerity. The result is, of course, you have debt laid upon debt. The crisis itself, though, has been precipitated already by the corporate debt problem. And we have a massive, massive problem here. And there were a few sources globally that are beginning to forewarn about this. They're beginning to say, danger, danger, red flags, etc. The Bank of International Settlements in Geneva keeps putting out these reports warning of this situation, particularly private corporate debt and in emerging markets and in China. But it's a problem everywhere. Corporations in the U.S., for example, with the very low Fed rates, have been borrowing from banks and other sources and using that borrowed money to pay their stockholders dividends and buy back stock. And those are loading up on debt in order to funnel the great riches of the financial speculation of the last 8 years to their big stockholders. And they're massively, $1 trillion a year, corporations in the U.S. Have been issuing debt, corporate debt. And that's just investment-grade debt. That's not the more fragile, unstable, what they call high-yield debt, or sometimes junk bond debt. So $1 trillion a year for 5 years. And now corporations are going to Europe and Japan, because over there they are issuing even lower-cost debt, corporate debt, and buying up the QE programs in ECB in Europe and in Japan, are buying private debt. They're not just buying back government debt, but they're buying private debt, which is an incentive for corporations to issue more debt, you see. And the corporations that issue more debt in Europe, they're issuing dollar debt in Europe, in Japan now, loading up just as they did $1 trillion a year here in the U.S. Now they're not just the U.S. loading up at that rate, but now loading up in Europe and Japan. So we're really more than $1 trillion a year. We're probably somewhere from $1 to $2 trillion a year in corporate debt because the central banks are buying private debt now and have been for a while. They've run out of buying up these QE programs, buying them government bonds, so now they're buying corporate bonds. And in Japan, they're not only buying bonds, they're buying stocks. So the central banks are becoming big ownerships of private corporations as they pump more and more money in to these economies and buy stocks and exchange-traded funds, which are kind of like index stocks, and other sources of private equity stock they're purchasing, and it seems like there's no end in sight as to what they will purchase. And, of course, when you have that much money, trillions by central banks trying to purchase stocks and bonds, it just creates a holiday. It drives up the price of stocks and bonds, and that's great. You know, the private speculators love that because, you know, the price of the stock that they bought is going up as well. That's why the stock markets and bond markets are stretched to such a point that huge, huge double, triple, 200% increases and so forth. And that's why the rich are getting so rich off these capital gains driven by the central banks buying up bonds and now stocks and everything. It's a system that's turned on its head, and it cannot be sustained in direction it's going, because it's still going in the direction. You know, there's no correcting of what's going on here, and the free money just keeps flowing into these financial asset markets and driving the prices up. And at the slightest indication that the prices need further driven, the central banks pump even more money. The central banks are engineering a global collapse of the economy. They're engineering it. And, you know, it's not the first time. Back in the 1930s, the central banks did something very similar, protecting the assets, the financial assets and currency values of the wealthy people. The central banks made the global depression in the 1930s, particularly the U.S. Federal Reserve, far worse than it might have been. They were partly the cause of that. And we see the same thing happening since 2008. To protect the financial values of wealthy stock and bondholders, they keep pumping money into the economy, trying to keep currencies up, because when currencies collapse, you lose paper profits, and that just fuels the problem. It doesn't solve it. It fuels the problem. But then, you know, central banks are really there for that purpose. You know, it's a bit of a fiction that central banks' purpose is to stabilize and supervise the private banking system. No, that's never been the case. When the U.S. Federal Reserve was created in 1913, it was created in order to bail out the banks, just as happened in 1907-8 when the great financial crash hit then. There was no central bank, and the private bankers, J.P. Morgan and all those guys, had to try to bail out the system themselves. And they pooled their money, and they still couldn't do it in 1907-8. So they had to call upon the U.S. government, the U.S. Treasury. And the Treasury dumped all of its available cash into the private banking system. And they kept the, you know, measly $5 million there and barely bailed out the banking system, prevented the Great Depression in 1907-8. In other words, the system's gotten too big, and it's politically unviable for elected politicians or agencies and bureaucrats, you know, who are accountable to elected governments like the Congress and so forth. You know, it's politically unviable to directly bail out the banks with taxpayer money. You see, that's what the central banks do. They create the money to bail out the banks, and it's, you know, kind of esoteric, and the average person doesn't know that the central banks, the Fed, is there to bail out the banks and the financial investors and so forth. That's its primary function. All the rest is secondary. You know, they do this token bank supervision stuff with phony stress tests that, you know, are just cover up, and you know, even controlling the money supply. They have no control over the money supply in a global economy. Now, that's a fiction, too, now. But bailing out the banks is what it's all about. And when I say banks, I mean shadow banks, not just commercial banks, you know, Chase and Wells and so forth. You know, I mean investment banks, you know, like Goldman Sachs and all the other kinds of shadow banks, the hedge funds, the private equity funds, you know, the boutique investment, this and that. All these are shadow banks. And multinational corporations have become shadow banks, too. Part of their operation is really all about financial asset investing, even more so than sometimes in some cases than the production side of their operations. And then all this online lending, LendingTree and so on and so forth, is a whole new development in the shadow banking. Shadow banking is where rich folks put their money to invest and speculate and take big risks, right? Commercial banks are where you and I put our little old deposits in Chase and Wells and Bank of America, and then Chase and Wells loan it to the shadow banks to speculate, you see. That's how the system works globally. Anyway, to back up, that's what my book earlier this year, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy, is all about, predicting that nothing has really changed since 2008-09. In fact, it's gotten worse. And if anything, the central banks are deeper in hock to the whole system and keeping it going and expanding on the financial side. And the problem with all this financial speculation investment is that it sucks money out of investing in real things globally, and that's why the global economy is slowing down. I argue that we got a grand diversion of money capital here going on into financial assets globally as financialization expands globally, and it's slowly sucking out the wind out of the sails of the real economy. It's a slow process, but it is occurring here. Okay, so that was my book earlier in the year. Now the book that's just being published, called Looting Greece, A New Financial Imperialism Emerges, is kind of a sequel to this financial crisis analysis. And that, it's an expression of how you see everywhere globally, the bigger, stronger economies are trying to suck the smaller economies into their vortex. We see this with all the free trade agreements, right? NAFTA, CAFTA, TPP. The European Union is a free trade zone, customs zone. China, and you know, attempting to do it over there, and South America, and Mercosur, and so forth. You know, it's a process of the bigger economies trying to control the smaller economies. And not just the smaller economies in the developing world, but on the fringes of the advanced economies like Europe, U.S., Japan, right, China. And a good example of what's in development financially is what's occurring in the periphery economies of Europe, particularly in the southern periphery. You know, Spain, even Italy, Ireland, Greece, Portugal, etc. These are becoming what I call in the book economic protectorates. And those not quite a colony, but economically a colony. Not something where they, you know, old time 19th century British colonialism, they, you know, send in a contingent of the British army, and they set up a British bureaucracy, and British companies come in, and they hire people at dirt level wages, barely subsistence wages, and they get them to produce textiles and stuff and natural resources, and they send those natural resources back to the home country. In that case, it was England, right? And then this low-cost, low-produced stuff, the English just sell within England. They re-export everywhere else in the world at great profit. So that's a form of imperialism with a political structure overlaid, colonial structure overlaid on a economic exploitation arrangement. Right, and they're sucking out the surplus, the value from a low wage, and then selling it at a higher price and reaping the difference. You know, that's traditional imperialism, and if necessary, there's a military element to that to conquer and set it all up and to keep it in control. Okay, in the 20th century, we have a different kind of imperialism, and then I argue in the 21st century, we have yet another kind emerging. In the 20th century, it's a U.S. imperialism classic, in which it's multinational corporations which relocate into these countries and strike a deal with the local elites, local capitalist elites, to give them a taste of the great profits. And you have international institutions like the World Bank, IMF, and so forth, controlled by the U.S., and you have the U.S. dollar, which means the Federal Reserve Central Bank and other Treasury and so forth agencies control the value of the dollar and manipulate the dollar to great advantage that allows them to suck out even more profits from these developing countries. So it has a minimal overlay of political military structure. Yeah, there are military bases, and the U.S. pumps up those military bases when occasionally it's necessary, and the local elites call on the U.S. to put down the insurrections. It's a fluid military response from the center to the periphery when necessary, and they keep token bases everywhere to do that, to enable that. But they work very closely with the local elites. They bring them back to the U.S. They train them at Harvard and places like that. They train their military at the School of Americas in the southern part of the United States, Georgia, I think it is, or Carolina. They link up with the local elites, and they let the local elites run the show locally, politically. You know, they have their elections and so forth, and as long as they are able to keep dominance over the rest of their society, the U.S. lets them go. But periodically, local elites lose control, and the U.S. Has to destabilize the economies there and allow them to come back and take control. And where do we see that happening? Well, we see it happening very clearly in Latin America now, don't we? Yes, very clearly. The U.S. helped engineer the takeover of the Argentine government by the business forces there, led by Macri. And immediately, what does Macri do? He pays off the U.S. hedge funds that the previous government refused to. Kirchner government refused to pay off the hedge funds who demanded full payment, even though they wrecked the economy of Argentina in the 90s. They still demanded full payment. Argentina offered them part payment, but some of them, like Paul Singer's group and others, hedge funds, big hedge funds, equity firms, insisted full payment, and you know, they waited and their time and everything, and it came here last year, and with the help of the U.S., they destabilized the economy in Argentina, took it over once again. And the first thing Macri government did once they took it over was to pay off $5 billion to pay off the hedge funds. And as soon as they did that, the money capital flowed to the local elites in Argentina, and now they're getting filthy rich off of the money coming in. Once again, speculative money. So that's how the local elites and the U.S. elites work together here cooperatively in the 20th and 21st century. And again, the result is the same. You exploit labor and smaller businesses and peasants and so forth, and take their stuff and sell it at a higher rate, right? Or speculate in their financial markets and make capital gains. And you can see it in Brazil, right? This week, what did we have? We had this phony coup d'etat of Dilma Rousseff, you know, the Workers' Party president there, and the Workers' Party has been in control of the government there for 13 years, and, you know, they've been funneling some of the gains back to the people, and no, they don't like that. You have this phony... Boy, if there was a legal coup that was phony, man, that's really the phoniest coup there ever was, you know, based on not on some criminal activity by the president, but simply doing what presidents there had always done, moving funds around between different uses in the government spending here and there. I mean, the U.S. government does it all the time, right? Democrats do it all the time, Republicans too. So they trumped it up. They trumped it up, and that's what they went after her for in a impeachment trial. Totally phony. But, you know, to get public support for that kind of a legal coup, what you got to do is wreck the economy. And that's what the central bank in Brazil did with the encouragement and assistance of the U.S. In other words, you drive up interest rates, which they did immediately in Brazil, as they did in Argentina, to 13-14%, and that brings the economy to an absolute halt. And you have massive unemployment and loss of income for working classes, and it neutralizes their support for their own government. At the same time, when you have such a collapse you have a collapse of the currency of the country, like the Brazilian real collapsed. And when you have a collapse of the currency, import prices accelerate proportionally. And that means since many of these developing countries are dependent on a lot of imports, inflation goes through the roof at the same time that unemployment goes through the roof. Well, now you've got inflation and unemployment, and you've got the vehicle for really destabilizing the economy, confusing people, and neutralizing support for their own government, because people have very short memories and don't understand the complexity of these economic relationships here. So, you know, you wreck the economy for a time being, and then the U.S. Works through its other agencies, you know, including CIA and foreign aid and everything, and funnels money into these business parties and into the media, and they really pump up, you know, the crisis and corruption, you see. Corruption is a big part of this play in this strategy. And in this case in Brazil, it was Petrobras, the government oil company. And they tried to make it stick that there was corruption and so forth, taking, you know, by Rousseff and so forth. Well, they didn't find anything that effective. But you make these claims enough times in the media, and you get enough people, writers and editorialists and talking heads, to lie about these things or insinuate, and people eventually believe it, whether it's proven or not, you see. And you combine that with the central bank policies creating inflation and unemployment, and you got a formula for destabilizing these governments. They did it in Argentina. They did it in Brazil, and they're really going after it in Venezuela. See, Venezuela's a little tougher because the government there, since Hugo Chavez, has really pumped a lot of benefits into the people, and it still has a lot of support. But, you know, the upper middle classes and business people and so forth, and the people they've been able to get to their side have been really going after it, the Venezuelan government, the Maduro government especially, for the last several years since Chavez died. Well, they tried under Chavez, too, but he had too much support of the military. But the U.S. plays a role in helping them destabilize them. And once again, you destabilize the currency. You cause unemployment, and you destabilize the currency. Well, they couldn't get the central bank down there in Venezuela to jack up interest rates. But they did destabilize the currency significantly, cause a big shortage of dollars, you see. And if you have a shortage of dollars, you cannot buy imports. And if you don't buy imports, then you bring imports into the country. Then what happens is inflation rises dramatically, right? Because what imports do creep in, there's a very short supply, and you know, when you have a real shortage of supply, it drives up prices. So you create this big inflation and a shortage of dollars, and businesses, U.S. and other businesses, go on strike. Yes, the capitalists do go on strike, and they went on strike and have been down there hoarding dollars even more. And the U.S. has attacked even those businessmen who were pro-regime, Venezuelan regime, indicted them many ways, indicted some of the military generals and so forth supporting the Chavez-Maduro regime, create this idea of corruption, right? And the U.S. even went so far as to set up in Colombia next door a special funnel for speculating in the currency, drive the currency down, the you know, what's available in the local currency, and drive the dollar up by creating shortages. Well, if you drive the dollar up, creating shortages, you're going to drive the other currency down at the same time because they exchange for each other. So, you know, these are just the outlines of how contemporary imperialism works. and in this case, destabilized. The U.S. model for destabilizing countries is much more sophisticated today in the 21st century than it was in the 1970s when they just sent in the Marines, you see. It's much more sophisticated, efficient, and from afar, you might say. And it's economic, you know, destroy the economy, which means that if you're trying to generate a people's government and a socialist kind of a government and an economy in these countries, and you don't have control over the central bank, or you don't have control over the money supply or credit, sources of credit, and or the media, what you end up with is a real crisis. Well, in my book, Looting Greece, New Financial Imperialism, I take this one step further. And I show how in Greece what's happened. And, you know, this is a European country, but it's a small country on the periphery of Greece, I mean, on the periphery of the Eurozone. And it's a case example of how financial imperialism really works today. Effective case example. And the key to financial imperialism is debt. You create debt that cannot be paid, and you use the ability of not paying, the country not paying the debt, the foreign debt provided by foreign central banks, in this case the European Central Bank, the Troika as they call it, European Commission with their special funds for loaning money, IMF, all three are called the Troika, and they've indebted Greece to an extent that Greece can never pay. And that allows them to go in and directly control the economy, take control of the economy, and set up arrangements where the state, in this case the Greek state, is forced to collect the debt payments on behalf of the Troika, the Eurozone. In other words, it's aggregated exploitation, state-to-state delivery of the surplus and the value extracted from the wage owners and small business people and so forth. It's much more efficient than ever before. It's on a massive scale that it goes on. But what you got to do is indebt the country first, get it totally indebted. And the way you're able to do that is by you suck them into these federations like customs unions, Eurozone, NAFTA, and so forth. You get them indebted, you suck them into that, and then you impose your currency as the sole currency. You see, that's necessary. And then if you've got a sole currency, you've got to have one banking union, one central bank. So the central bank and the currency overlaid on top of a free trade goods zone creates this structure that is necessary for indebting these smaller periphery economies. And indebting means that, you know, you're making all these loans to them so they can repay old loans. Over $400 billion has been loaned to Greece since 2008-09. $400 billion. Well, they can never pay that. Their GDP is less than $200 billion. How are they ever going to pay $400 billion back, right? Well, if they can't pay it back, the Troika gives them more credit, more loans to repay the previous credit and loans, you see? Of the $400 billion, a recent study, as I said last week, worth mentioning again, of the European School of Management and Technology in Berlin, actually, ironically, indicates that 95% of all the loans and debt extended to Greece by the Troika has been repay for purposes of repayment back to the Troika, back to the institutions, and back to the national central banks in Europe, who then, you know, use it to redistribute the money to the private banks, who redistribute it to their private investors, you see? So it's a big circular money flow of interest on the debt that's extended, that comes back. Well, that's financial exploitation. You know, interest payments are financial payments. It's not like a factory that exploits workers in traditional imperialism, economic imperialism, and sends the money back to corporate headquarters in the home country, right? Well, that goes on, too. That hasn't ended. But that's just a company-by-company process of exploitation. What we're talking about here is a financial exploitation. Financial. There are other forms, too. It's not just country-to-country principal and interest on the debt payment and that money flow coming back to the center, in this case, the ECB, the Troika, national central banks, etc. No, not just that. Well, at the same time, when the central government, in this case, the European Commission and ECB, enter into a debt agreement with these periphery economies, you know, to pay the interest in massive amounts, they also say that you must engage in austerity in order to pay it. Right. In other words, you've got to make sure you make these payments. You've got to squeeze it out of your people, which means that, we don't want you spending, government, because you've got to pay us. We don't want you spending on your own economy. You've got to pay us. A good example is the last $98 billion extended to Greece last year in August, a year ago. $98 billion. Only $8 billion of that will actually be spent in Greece. The rest will be recycled back to the banks. In Germany and elsewhere, right? So to ensure that the government can make these payments, what the Troika and others do is make them privatize, sell off their government assets, their ports, their roads, their railroads, their utilities, and so forth. So that creates another money flow, a financial money flow, you see, because they set up these deals where the Europeans can come in, Northern Europeans can come in and buy up these public assets at fire sale prices. And then they run them, and the fees they get from them, they send that back to the core countries like Germany and Belgium and so forth, Netherlands. So that's another form of financial speculation. And then in the whole process, yet another form occurs, and that is when these crises and these renegotiations occur, the debt, the government has to raise money in markets, private bond markets, and the cost to the government, the interest rate, rises significantly by speculators, global speculators, including the U.S. They buy up these government bonds, and the government has to pay them, 12-13%, huge rates. Yeah? So that's another form of money flow, financial back to private speculators and imperialist interests. There are still other forms. You have volatility in the stock market, up and down, and speculators come in. You have credit default swap markets that make big profits off of all this. And during the crises, rich Greek businesses and investors withdraw their cash from the Greek banks and send it to northern banks. That's another money flow back. There are all forms, kinds of forms, that are part of this new financial imperialism that's going on. And Greece is the case example of this. But it's all a product and made possible because of the financialization of the global economy and capitalism itself, as capitalism shifts to financial investment away from less profitable a real investment, in things that create jobs and so forth. And this shift, financialization shift, is not just a question of the growth of what some people, Hudson and others, call the FIRE sector, finance, real estate, insurance and real estate. No, that's far too narrow. Financialization is this whole global structure that's occurred with, shadow banks and all the highly liquid financial asset markets that have been created globally, linked electronically, instantaneously. Money investments move around instantaneously to arbitrage and make money here one day, and then they shift it and make it money there the other day. And behind it all are real agents, you see. And the problem with this FIRE, F-I-R-E, narrow definition of financialization is that where's the finance capitalists, right? It's industries, right? No. People behind all this are actual individuals, you see. The Paul Singers and all the others, hedge fund guys and equity guys, Carlyle Group, etc. So it's the individual. You know, capitalism shields the individual from attention here, tries to at least, you know, by talking in abstractions about industries and markets as if markets, you know, were some sort of personification, and it wasn't really just people behind the markets. You know, there are about 200,000 new finance capital elites across the world who are truly global. You know, they may live in one country. Actually, they live in several countries all at once, and they probably carry more than one passport, as if they needed passports. So, you know, it's this finance capital elite that's running the show now. And they've captured pretty much the central banks. The central banks are just doing their bidding for them. So this is the new financial imperialism. I have chapters on the new finance capital elite itself, you know, in the book Systemic Fragility. But how they operate on a case example, local example, is this case of Greece, right? And the book just released Looting Greece, how they loot Greece, steal from Greece. And not just Greece, but a lot of these peripheral economies, more and more, by indebting them. A good example is, you know, how has Puerto Rico been and gotten in debt by almost $100 billion? You know, who loaned Puerto Rico all this money, and now they want the debt payments paid? You know, Puerto Rico is kind of like the U.S. Greece, at least moving in that direction. And there are other examples beginning to emerge as well. This is an emerging new kind of imperialism based on financial assets and financial flows. And, you know, most traditional theorists of imperialism are still looking at Lenin and, you know, Hilferding and all those others and how that imperialism worked over a century ago. Well, it hasn't stayed still. It's evolved. Just as capitalism has evolved globally, and you need to understand how it's changed in the 21st century. You know, I have these running debates with some Marxists, you know, and who seem to be unable to adapt basic Marxist analysis into the 21st century. You know, what they do is just quote, you know, the text, you know, which is kind of biblical, I think. In any event, they haven't brought it up to date. Well, and if you don't bring the financial analysis and the financialization of the global economy into this picture, you will never understand what's going on. Okay, so that's my plug here for my two books. You can get the latest book on Clarity Press, C-L-A-R-I-T-Y Press, .net, and you can go to ClarityPress/Rasmus HTML, and new book, which is an extension of the previous book. And there will be another one coming early next year on how the central banks are exacerbating the problem and the crash, called Central Banks, Bankers on the Ropes, Monetary Policy, and the Coming Next Depression. All right. Let's talk about some of the major points in the last week here, worth mentioning here in the last quarter hour of the show. Right? What's happened this past week that's notable, worth watching? Well, we got the job numbers, U.S. job numbers today, right? Only 151,000, well below their forecast, right? But above their even worse performances in recent months. And it's getting mixed reviews. You know, if you look behind the scene here, behind these numbers, you see they're really, really pretty weak, once again, in keeping with recent months. And what are these weaknesses in these numbers, right? Well, first of all, the number of jobs occurs with a reduction in the number of hours worked. That's another labor indicator, you see. If you're reducing hours worked, you can't have growth going on. It means businesses are cutting back hours. They're not laying people off yet, but they're cutting back the hours. And they aren't providing wage increases. Wage growth has slowed, which has always been skewed to the top end anyway. But these behind-the-scenes indicators show that those numbers, even 150,000, are pretty weak. But it's especially weak when you identify the fact that 113,000, there's been an increase of 113,000 jobs last month in involuntary part-time work. Well, when you get this part-time growth, once again, what you've got is businesses cutting back. You know, they're, as they have been, you know, they lay off full-time workers and they hire part-time back, or they cut full-time to part-time. And 113,000 in 1 month, that's pretty big, right? In other words, the numbers would be really poor, like they were last month or the month before, if you did not have that growth of 113,000 involuntary part-time jobs. And then there's this other funny development in the numbers which make them suspect to me, and that is some of this 151,000 is because of a growth in education jobs over the summer. You know, the last couple of months, education has grown by 60,000 jobs. But, you know, that's very seasonal. There's something wrong with their seasonality as assumptions and adjustments with these job numbers I've been saying for months now, right? It's particularly strange that you would get 60,000 education jobs during the summer if you look at last May to the May before, and it was May 2015 to May 2016, there was no increase in education jobs. Why, after a year of no increase, we would have this surge of 60,000 over the summer? It doesn't make sense to me, right? Another signal here, warning sign, is that healthcare jobs, which have been growing robustly for some time, now are down to only 14,000 jobs created last month. This is, you know, these are signals beneath the surface here that these numbers are not all that reliable and not all that strong. Okay. Another area of numbers that are questionable is U.S. factory numbers. Well, maybe they're not so questionable because they show a distinct contraction. U.S. factory growth by the ISM index, right, the notable index, you know, that everyone uses to measure factory manufacturing growth globally here, for the U.S. contracted. You know, as it fell below 50. 50 is a numerical value that shows that there's no growth. So if it's below 50, it's a contraction. Well, it went from 52.6 in July to 49.4. A major contraction here in 1 month. Which is really strange because usually you have a boost before the elections, a boost in this kind of activity. But now, you know, it shows that the economy may be even far weaker U.S. than people believe. And behind the causative numbers here, behind the factory number, aggregate factory number 49.4, is that we see new orders and employment and inventories all contracting faster last month than they did before. The end of auto production growth is now upon us. Even the auto companies are saying so. I've been saying for months, watch autos here, because there's been a significant run-up in auto production and sales driven by these tremendous discounts and extending of terms. You know, the average I think now is 72 months. It used to be 3 years. You buy an auto, pay it in 3 years. Now, you know, they stretch it out 72 months. That's the only way people can pay the higher prices, you see. And they give all these special incentives, you know, nothing down, drive off zero, etc. So, you know, people have based on debt, big debt, and auto debt has gone through the roof. It's over $1 trillion now. You know, not as big as subprime, problems, but we have subprime auto debt. We have the same problem there in autos that we had in housing before the last crash. I predict there's going to be serious problems with the auto sector in 2017. It's one of the reasons why I predict that there's going to be a recession in the U.S. in 2017. Productivity is flat. It's not growing at all. Manufacturing, of course, is only 12% of the total U.S. economy, but this ISM indicator, manufacturing, is a very high predictive indicator of where the economy is going. Very high predictability with the ISM. Even though manufacturing is only 12%, it drives a lot of the economy. And if it's turned south, you can bet. And if it's turned south 2 months before the election, what's it going to be after the election? When the Fed raises interest rates, which the Fed may already do in September. There's some choice, some possibility, rather. Bill Gross, the big bond guru, predicts that the Fed will raise rates in September here, which means they'll raise it in December. Well, I think it's 50-50 chance they'll raise in September, but a 90% chance they'll raise in December. Why is the Fed now going to raise rates, and why hasn't it done it up to now? Well, this is my analysis. One, they've got to raise rates because 8 years of near zero rates is causing a major, major problem in the pension funds and insurance funds, insurance companies. Pension funds, insurance companies cannot make any returns on fixed incomes, you see. And there's a crisis, a major crisis brewing in pensions and insurance annuities here, and they know it. The Fed and the elites in this country, and they can't let it go on any longer. So I predict they're going to raise rates. Also retirees. Retirees haven't been able to make anything on their savings, their basic savings accounts here for 8 years. You know, these zero rates have amounted to a massive income transfer from retired families, 50 million plus, to banks and financial speculators. The low rates have been a boon to stocks and bonds and speculators, right, as they've prevented and sucked money out of retirees' funds. So it's, it's in fact a transfer. The Fed has engineered a massive transfer from consumption-based income for retirees from their fixed savings to financial speculators and stocks and bonds. And, that's a fact. 8 years. But it's wrecking the economy. It's causing distortions. And it's not the only distortion that it's causing. Another reason why the Fed hasn't raised rates up until now is because of multinational corporations. You know, if the Fed raises rates, the U.S. dollar rises, and the currencies of other countries, particularly in Latin America and elsewhere, emerging markets, collapses. Well, if the currencies collapse, then the U.S. multinational corporations doing business in those countries register significant profit declines. And they've been the Fed has been reluctant to do that to protect the offshore U.S. multinational corporate profits. That's the main reason why it hasn't raised rates. Also, they will destabilize some of these emerging markets even further. Their currencies will collapse. Capital will flow out of these currencies. Their stock markets and bond markets will be in trouble. And, of course, that impacts U.S. financial speculators' offshore profits, as well as multinational corporate offshore profits. They're just trying to, just succeeding in engineering these legal coups in Latin America and elsewhere. They don't want to level a crashing economy on the new business elites that are taking over down there. But another major reason the U.S. hasn't done it, because of agreements it has with China, for China not to devalue its currency. Because if China devalues the yuan, and it's creeping in that direction, if it does so, then it will really set off a major currency war across the globe here. We'll have big negative effects on global trade, which is already stagnant, The U.S. has deals with with Beijing on economic, you don't do this, we won't do this, right? They work out these one-on-one deals every year with them. And part of the deal is don't devalue. Hmm? Well, if the U.S. raises interest rates, the dollar goes up, well, it's going to cause a devaluation anyway in the Chinese currency. But the Fed, in other words, central bank, the main central bank of the world, is behind the eight ball. Damned if it doesn't, damned if it doesn't, you see. And they've been waffling. You know, they raise rates, which they have to in the U.S., to ensure continued U.S. savings and consumption and to prevent a collapse of the pension funds insurance companies, right? Either that, or they don't raise rates and they protect U.S. multinational corporations and emerging markets in China, right? That's the dilemma they face. They're really walking the tightrope here, right? I believe, nonetheless, that they are now going to move to raise rates here, certainly in December. What that means is that we're going to get one or two rates this year. But I predict there will be fiscal spending as a cover for this, infrastructure spending, you know. They'll hope to stimulate the economy to offset the rate rise that will contract the economy here, and it will be a nice arrangement to push through corporate tax cuts as part of the fiscal new program that will come right after the elections here. But this infrastructure tax cut stuff will be too little too late. It will not stimulate the economy enough to offset the contraction of the economy that will occur with these interest rate rises, right? So that's why I predict there's a recession coming in 2017-18, and it will come on top of this global problem of the global economy contracting. The IMF just issued a report to the G20 nations about the continued slowdown of the global economy. The UK is headed for a slowdown, it predicts. Weaker growth in the EMEs, emerging markets, especially if U.S. raises rates. U.S. growth now is less than 1% average so far in the first half of this year. And China is slowing down somewhere between 3 and 4, now it's reported 6 to 7%. So the IMF is now saying, oh, we need to do more fiscal spending, infrastructure spending, and structural reform. Which is, I've always said, labor market reform, which is a code word for squeeze wages and squeeze jobs. And that's what the major next thrust is going to be. It's going to be structural reform. We see it emerging already in Europe, in particular in Japan and emerging markets. Of course, they're going to squeeze people like they are already beginning in Brazil and in Argentina. So this is the major developments. The IMF report, the Bank of International Settlements report says the same thing. The Fed development, what's going to happen, as I've just predicted, is going to happen. And in the meantime, Apple is refusing to pay more than 2% tax that it pays in Ireland on its $200 billion cash hoard, 90% of which it's holding offshore. That's the other major news. Okay, this was Alternative Visions, Jack Rasmus, and we'll be talking next week more about developments in the proposals of Trump. Is Trump being tamed? Okay, the taming of Trump topic next week.